Hello, this is Lewis.
And this is Ian.
And welcome to 101 Films You Should Have Seen.
Probably.
Hello. We're back again.
Yes.
Twice in a year.
Yeah, we're on a roll. This is it, Lewis. We've finally got our shit together. And we've got the band back together. And yeah, this is it. It's going to be podcast after podcast after podcast.
You know, I was looking back in the early days, and we were doing a podcast a week, Ian. Can you imagine that?
No, I can't imagine that. Because
that high rate of turnover.
Let's break that down. That was watching probably roughly a two-hour film on average a week. Yeah. On top of that, we'd have to record the podcast, which usually takes about an hour. And we used to go to each other's houses as well, so that was an entire evening. Yeah. One of us would then have to edit the podcast, which normally takes about 3 hours. And the other one would have to write, and we used to write whole blog entries about each film as well, which again would take 2 or 3 hours. So we were spending a lot of time on this podcast at the beginning.
How carefree we were back then, back in our spirited youth.
And also, I would say probably, I'm not sure those podcasts are any better than the ones we do now. All the care and attention we used to lavish on them.
I think now we're better than we've ever been. We've just trimmed all the fat. We're down to the bare basics.
Indeed.
People have actually emailed me and said they just like listening to our voices, that it relaxes
good.
Them.
That's good.
But, you know, it's just nice to know that someone is out there just relaxing in their deep bath and listening to us.
Are they not just saying that we're boring? Is that just why? Well, the thing about the
wasn't quite
one
sure
films,
of the sentiment. I mean, it seemed to be a positive sentiment the way I was reading it. I mean, maybe that's just the way I was reading it.
We've certainly become much more relaxed. Indeed, when I listened to our last podcast, I realised we didn't actually describe the plot of the film. We just went straight into just talking generally about it and had no real
description. That's what Wikipedia's for, right?
Yeah. Let's make our listeners work for their supper.
Exactly. Come on.
Well, I'm particularly pleased to be back for this podcast because this is... We have a fine tradition at 101 Films of doing a Halloween special.
Exactly, yes. It's something we've barely missed, I don't think, in the long time we've done this. Also, weirdly, we do a Valentine's Day special. I'm not quite sure why.
And a Christmas special. And a Christmas special. We do tend to hit the big holidays, the high holidays.
Valentine's Day always seems a little like the odd one out, but I suppose we are big romantics at heart.
Indeed. And for Halloween, it's just an excuse to talk about scary films. And scary films do tend to be short as well, which is always which also is a nice, pleasing thing we do love here at 101 Films.
Oh yeah, we love a short film. We love a short. Not a big fan of scary movies these days, I've got to say. I must admit, I'm getting to be a bit of a wuss.
Really? What's the last modern day scary film you watched?
I can't even think of a modern day one. If I do watch a scary film, it's more likely to be a 70s one.
Yeah, probably the last recent horror film I saw, I would say, is Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, it's not really a horror film. Though,
it's probably
it's kind
about
of a,
horror films rather
it's
a than a horror
pastiche,
film.
If anything.
Yeah,
I don't know, but then it is quite scary in places. I don't know.
Yeah, it's an awkward one.
It is. It straddles the boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, before that, maybe perhaps it was even the American remake of The Ring was the last actual scary film.
God, now we're going back, aren't we?
Yeah, that's a good. I mean, that must be at least 10 years old.
Yeah. I must say, the Girl with All the Gifts, which is out last week, I think, this week, looks very good, though. If I was going to break my horror fast, I'd probably go for that one.
Well, there are a few that I have read about or heard about that do sound quite interesting. Things like, is it the Babadook or the Baduk?
The Babadook.
Babadook. What's the other one? It Follows, I think, where a girl sleeps a song and then something...
It's funny, we sound like just two old men trying to be current. What's the name of that band? You know, with the Bang Bang music.
Well, why do you think we're growing out of horror films then?
Well, I think we've covered this in previous Halloween
specials,
and a lot of it is
in the Tobe Cooper special. Actually, we talked
exactly,
a lot about this, didn't we?
Yeah. The existential dread, the realization that our short lives must be snuffed out at some point, ever nearer in the future.
I do. I mean, just as a, in a way, I've gone off films that are, for want of a better description, depressing, I suppose. They're kind of a separation type films where it's like, yeah. Oh, it's an Iranian drama about divorce. Oh, songs had a miscarriage. Yeah, it's the sort of thing.
Oh, but I really shouldn't laugh at that. But that,
you're
like,
oh, do I really? Because I remember when we were discussing last year, I think when we did our 9 to 5 podcast.
When incidentally, one of our most popular podcasts ever.
Well,
I'll just throw
it's
that
a
in.
Good film. But I do remember you saying, oh, what should we do? 9 to 5 or Kez? And I was just like, let's do 9 to 5. Because the thought of watching Kez, which I'm sure is an amazing film. Indeed, everyone says that, what a great film it is. But yeah. I just knew it was going to probably be a beautiful film, but not the most uplifting of films.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, to be fair, since having a baby, I just don't want to watch sad films anymore. Whereas before, I was all about miserable.
You were, yeah. You loved miserable films.
I was constantly offering up miserable films.
Yeah,
to watch.
You did. I was like, oh, God.
And nowadays, I struggle. But the last few films I've watched have all been Marvel superhero films, I think.
Yes, it does explain why those films are popular, I guess, because you just get a little, maybe not, and obviously not everyone, but certainly quite a few people I know, as they've got older, just lose interest in films that are difficult.
Yeah. I think I do have experienced a kind of softening of the mind, I think, as a parent. I find it hard to kind of concentrate and take in stuff, or be willing to, you know.
And for horror films, I think it's a similar situation. I just don't want to be, I don't know, I just don't want, I just like, oh, that's unpleasant. Yeah, that's a horrible thing to happen. Yeah, that's rather than being excited or thrilled. I just feel vaguely depressed by a horror film.
I think, well, before we started the podcast, we were talking about how, you know, when you've got such little free time, you have to choose wisely what to do in it.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, do you want to watch a film that is probably going to be really, really miserable in your allotted 2 hours of film watching per week?
Yeah.
Or are you going to watch The Incredible Hulk and just have a, you know, a popcorn-fueled ride into ecstasy?
what a wonderful way of putting it. The other thing I perhaps have considered, and maybe this is partly to do with getting older, I wonder if actually whether I ever really liked horror films that much, and I was just more pretending I liked them through a sense of bravado because I wanted to appear brave in front of people. And as I get older, I don't care. Whereas when I was 21, I wanted to see a horror film just to tell people, oh yeah, I've seen a horror film, I don't care.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was like a rite of passage in a way. Saying you'd seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was like, oh, I've seen the Texas Chainsaw. Oh my God, is it crazy? You know, like, there was legends grew up around certain films. I remember having A Nightmare on Elm Street described to me in excited, sweaty schoolboy tones in the playground when I was at primary school. You know, if someone's dad had got a bootleg video or something, and you know, and then was explaining to a rapt crowd about exactly what happened and all the deaths in all gory details. And we're transfixed by these tales. You know, it's kind of maybe trying to be adult.
Yeah,
in a way. Whereas I guess we don't have to do. We've got nothing to prove now.
But it's quite interesting. Obviously, we're talking about becoming parents because the subject of this year's 101 Films Halloween special is all about that magical moment of becoming a parent.
Exactly, the magical moment of childbirth. Of course, we're talking about Rosemary's Baby, which is, when we were picking a horror film for Halloween this year, it had to be this one, surely.
Indeed, yes,
Also, we should note, this has been on the list, the hallowed 101 list for... Well, let's put it this way. It was added, I think it was a recommendation from one of your old flames. and considering when you were still seeing her, and considering you're now married and have a child with someone else.
That just also shows quite how long we've been doing this podcast.
Exactly, yeah.
10,000 years.
We do get round to the requests eventually. But very much eventually.
Actually, I have to ask you off mic what old flame recommended it, because I certainly don't remember. But
well, that just makes it worse. But that's a special egg to the pudding.
Because I'd never seen Rosemary's Baby before. But it's a film actually, when I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is almost like a classic Wong Kar Wai films film. It's set in New York, 1970s New York.
Yeah, exactly.
Late 1960s New York. New York. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a perfect for us. We love late 60s to early 80s New York. It's like the median Wong Kar Wai films film.
I think we should retire to 70s New York. I think
riding around on a very heavily graffitied subway train.
Exactly. I think we should retire as two maverick detectives in 70s New York. That would be, if we could just get locked into that timeline, that would be the ideal situation for me, I think.
Well, we're both Gene Hackman from French Connection.
I would have a very, very, very large Afghan coat.
Yes.
Brown aviator sunshades.
Yeah, yeah. And I would wear a leather jacket, a kind of white polo neck, checked flares.
Nice.
And I'd always be smoking. Just always smoking. Whatever you say, if I'm in the bath, I'd always be smoking. And we'd be walking along and we'd be like eating, I don't know, a bagel, and you would just see, it just has that kind of grey tinge to everything. Everything is just slightly grey.
I imagine I would have very wide-legged corduroy flares, and I'd secrete a shiv up one of my socks, and that would be my signature weapon. And so whenever we were faced with a bad guy, I'd whip out my shiv and throw it across the room.
And most importantly, we would be, you know, physically quite repellent. We would, you know, like, we would perhaps have a missing tooth.
Grey skin.
Yeah, like
sallow eyes.
You know, like, we've got sort of a strange blemish across our neck. But we would date quite sort of almost suspiciously young, quite attractive women.
That's true, because that's just what you did in the 70s.
Yeah, in the 70s, that's what happened.
No one batted an eyelid.
No, it was encouraged. and then, of course, we'd now be arrested by Operation U-Tree. So. anyway, so Rosemary's Baby. We should give a very brief description of the film, because it's actually quite easy to sum up.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's about witches, essentially.
Well, yeah, a young couple move into a new apartment, and the girl falls pregnant in slightly strange circumstances, and she starts to believe that there are a coven of witches living in her building who have intentions towards her child.
Mm, that's it. But the good thing about the film is that she's never completely sure of what's going on.
No.
I think as the audience, you're kind of fairly sure you know what's happening, but she's never quite sure. And
Now, I suppose we should probably say this film, you know, it's quite difficult to talk about without spoiling it to some extent.
Mm. We're going to have to talk about the ending because it's just so
well,
good.
Well, the entire film builds towards the ending, because that's one of the interesting things about this film. Not much happens.
Yeah.
Really, not a huge amount happens throughout the entire film. It's a building of tension, though, of dread, of anxiety, that then all comes to a head right at the very end of the film. Mm-hmm. So we kind of almost have to talk about the ending. So,
okay, cue the Awooga spoiler klaxon. So, we're going to talk about the ending. But first, I've got to say just how brilliantly shot this film is. I've got to say how Roman Polanski, the director, he does an amazing job of shooting this film. Most of the kind of the film is actually just in one apartment, and it provides such a brooding sense of claustrophobia. Like, almost every shot is framed through a doorway, or is down a corridor, so you always have walls surrounding you, and it just feels so. You feel like you're in there with Rosemary. You're just kind of like, just almost held prisoner.
Yeah, there's very few cuts as well, which I think enhances that feeling of claustrophobia. You feel like you're trapped there. You can't. It's not a cut away. You're just stuck there, and you feel like you're right there with her, and there's no real escape. You're sort of just going through this experience, along with the character. So Mia Farrow playing Rosemary. It's an interesting performance, because I don't know about you, but at the beginning I didn't particularly like her. Mm. I didn't really feel that warm towards her. Mm. But then as the film went on, I became more and more on her side. Mm. Now, I don't know if that was just one of those things, or it was just my personal reaction to it, or whether that was something they really wanted to do with the film. But I don't know. I at the beginning, I was a bit like, yeah, okay, oh yeah, she just seems a little bit slightly annoying, to be honest. But then you just feel, yeah, by the end of the film, you're totally on her side.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's really an amazing performance by Mia Farrow, because I think another actress playing that role could quite easily have just come across as purely irritating, because she's got, in a lot of ways, she is a really irritating character. She's got no self drive. It's seemingly her entire existence is to please her husband. You know,
yes,
she's like a naive child. You know, she kind of repapers shelves and then comes home and says, "Look what I've done! You know, I've made some shelves." You know, it's like
and she does come across in that. You're right, in a very childlike way. The way she talks, she often has a slightly almost childlike tone to her voice, like,
yeah, exactly.
Oh, why are you doing this? That kind of like a slightly babyish tone. But of course, I mean, ultimately, this film is about abuse of a woman, because
that's the thing, and the fact that she is so naive and kind of looks up to her husband and the other people around her, and kind of like, it makes it all the more despicable the way she's completely betrayed.
Yes, but
and sickeningly by her own husband, who essentially sells her out for a movie role.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's horrendous. He allows her to be raped by the devil,
so
that he can get a role and on a movie. And his rival for the role is blinded by the coven as kind of like payment. It's just horrific. Incidentally, he was played by Tony Curtis, the guy on the phone. I don't know if you know.
I did read that. Yeah, but I mean, that's quite an interesting question. So, so that's the reason why it turns out that the husband is in on the coven, and he is allowed Rosemary to be raped by the devil, by Satan himself. So because he's done a deal to become, as he plays an actor, so he now is going to have a successful acting career. And there is, right from the beginning, though, that it's because I don't think apparently the guy who plays Rosemary's husband, it's an actor called John Castanets, I think, or Coaston.
Yeah,
Castanets. I must admit, a guy I'd not come across before.
I've seen him before in I've seen him in TV dramas. I'm sure he's been in Columbo.
Well, of course, that's everyone. So, I think we have appeared in an episode of Columbo. From reading around the film, I don't think he was particularly happy while on set with Roman Polanski. But it's an interesting form, because right from the off, there is something just off about him. You don't like him that much. Mm. He does come across as a slightly arrogant bugger.
Yeah. But he's also not, you know, classically evil looking.
No. He's a quite handsome guy.
Yeah. Whereas I think they considered Jack Nicholson for the role, and I think Roman Polanski in the end said he was brilliant, but he just looked too suspicious and too kind of like nasty. Whereas with this guy, he's kind of like, the banality of the evil, I think, is what really makes it work. You know, it's just a bunch of old ladies and, you know, slightly crap actors summoning the devil, and that's the scariness about it. And I think that's the scariness of witchcraft. I can only think of a handful of movies that are actually covered witchcraft. You know, we've done Night of the Demon, I think, is one of them, and most of them are old. Another one I watched, which we talked about doing for this special actually, which was Night of the Eagle, another night film, which is also a very good film. But again, in that film, it's all about the banality of evil. Like, the witchcraft is just helping someone to advance their career, and, you know, but they go to extreme lengths to do it. And actually, there's been very few really good films about witches. You know, it's a subject that's surprisingly not covered that often.
There's a couple. There's what was the film we watched at the BFI? Sort of medieval sets.
Oh, Blood and Satan's Claw.
Blood and Satan's Claw, which is an odd film, but that's essentially about witches or demons or evil taking over a small village.
I probably wouldn't even count. I was thinking the Blair Witch Project, but I probably wouldn't even count the Blair Witch Project, because to me that's a monster film. It's not really about witchcraft at all. You know,
I think that's the thing that works quite well with witches films. It's the sort of slight sense of art. Is it real? Is it not real? Are they witches? And actually, that was an element of that I didn't feel was perhaps as played up as much as I thought it was going to be, where I actually thought that it would be more ambiguous as to whether actually Rosemary was the victim of some kind of evil coven, or well, whether it was all in her mind. But the film did see, came across much more that it definitely is in her mind, it's definitely all real.
Yeah, I think, that the rape scene pretty much cements it. You know, it's kind of like she's dreaming, but it's kind of heavily implied that, this is actually happening. Whereas I think in the book, I've not read the book, but from what I've read, apparently it was a lot more ambiguous. And certainly in the book, the ending is a big surprise.
Yeah.
She, in the book, she thinks that they're going to take her baby all the way through. Yes. They want to take the baby to eat, because they're or using ritual sacrifice.
Yeah, and like in the Roald Dahl book, The Witches, where they eat children.
Of course, exactly. And whereas actually, and in the book, the idea that actually, she's been raped by the devil and she's about to give birth to the Antichrist is kind of like a, what? Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose you could argue that that was her hallucinating. Before the ending of the film, you could argue that that's her hallucinating. Because that's the thing, when she wakes up the morning after being raped, and I would just say that it's more of a dreamlike scene, isn't it? It's not a graphic or horrific, well, it's a horrible scene, but it's not a graphic scene, is it? It is a dreamlike, weird, it's more surreal imagery.
It is a very good dream sequence. Yeah. I like the bit of the guy waving around a net in the desert kind of thing. Just seemingly
And actually, the dream sequences in this I thought were very well done and felt like dreams. Like characters turning away when they turn back, they're different characters. Elements like that, going all the way back to when we just talked about Inception, and my big problem was that none of the dreams felt like dreams, whereas this captures what it feels like to have a nightmare quite well.
But
when she awakes the next morning from this, and she goes, I felt I had a dream, essentially she says, I had a dream, I was raped by the devil, and she sees claw marks on her. To cover this, her husband's like, I raped you. That's essentially what he says. He says while she had passed out, he decided to have sex with her.
Yeah.
And she just goes, right. Which, now, I know she is supposed to be a kind of put upon, naive, perhaps not staying out with herself, but that's unbelievable. Now I don't think you would be just able to accept
But that's what makes it such a brilliant scene, because it is something that is horrendous. And you wouldn't accept that if someone just said that to you. But the fact that she does is kind of shows you what kind of place she's in at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
The fact that she kind of is, she doesn't like it, but she's also like, is quick to brush it off. Whereas by the end of the film, she's not that person anymore.
Yeah.
I think this is a horror film in the sense that it's domestic horror.
Yes, like, yeah.
The horror that's visiting is psychological all the way through. And the very most horrific scene in the film is undoubtedly the bit where she goes to see her previous doctor.
Yes.
She finally has all the evidence. She realizes that actually, she's being manipulated and something's happened to her baby and everyone's a witch and they're kind of all gang up her, even her doctor, the people have been referred to. So she goes back to her old doctor pleading for help. She's desperate. He's the only person she can turn to. And he sells her out.
Yeah.
And he's not a witch. Now that's the horrific bit. He's not even part of it. He's just a doctor seeing someone who's in distress and is happy to just chop her back to the people that are tormenting her.
Slightly.
I think that was the most disturbing scene in the whole film.
Well, slightly bizarrely, it reminded me of a plot line from the first series of Mad Men, where Betty Draper is having therapy, and she goes and sees a counsellor. And then halfway through the series, she discovers that the counsellor, basically at the end of every counselling session, she goes home, and then the counsellor phones her husband and tells him everything that she's been talking about.
Oh, no.
And it's that sense of no one's listening to it, or it's just men just making decisions on her behalf, or their behalf. And that scene really reminded me of that, that sense that she's trying to tell someone. And I did think why she said, I was like, just don't talk about the witches stuff. Say that there is someone that you're feeling a lot of pain, and like you could tell this story in a different way. That's the sort of don't go in the locked room kind of thing. Yeah. But it was that sense, as you say, of just no one listening to it, and then someone actually being well-meaning chucks her back into the claws of this horrific cult.
Mm. The literal claws.
Yeah, the literal claws. Yes. Well, one thing I didn't realise was, you mentioned that the film is based on a book, and the book is written by Ira Levin, who also wrote Stepford Wives, and
very good film,
The Boys from Brazil. But the interesting thing is, someone pointed out as I was reading that a lot of his books are about conspiracies and about groups of things. And the more interestingly, Stepford Wives in particular is again about sexism. Is about men going off, making decisions for their wives, and actually getting rid of their wives to have compliant robots instead, so women don't answer back. But essentially, so it's just quite it's sort of an interesting trend in this. It's just interesting. So what would you say is your favourite scene in the film? What stands out? I don't know if favourite is the right word for this film.
I think, there's actually quite a few different bits. I mean, when I was watching this film on Friday night, and it was actually quite late, and I thought, I'll stick it on, I'll watch the first bit. And I was just so gripped that I ended up just staying up to ridiculously late in the morning to watch the whole thing, because I just couldn't turn it off. It was just like, oh my God, it's so good. I've forgotten how good it was.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite scenes is the bit in the phone box.
Yes.
Which is a really long take, and Mia Farrow just nails it, absolutely nails it. You know, you can see all of the emotions passing across her face, the fear, the panic, the kind of bit where she's geeing herself up in the middle, kind of, come on, you can do this.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful kind of scene. And also the revelation scene, which it's interesting how powerful that scene is. You never actually see the baby. You never see the baby.
No.
You only see her reaction to the baby. And it is an amazing bit of acting, and it's so powerful that after I saw the film the first time, I could have sworn I'd seen the baby, and I was surprised.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you have an image of the baby in your head? Because I do as well. Yeah.
And yet, I watched it the second time. I was like, oh, they never show the baby.
No.
And I was like, and yet I could have sworn I could have described it to you. So that's how powerful that scene is. You know.
Yeah, definitely. Going back to the phone booth scene. I totally agree. I think it is incredibly tense. So, Rosemary is just run out from her evil doctor. So she's found out the doctor she's seeing, Dr. Saperstein, is in on the coven. She's like, oh my God. So she runs out, she tries to phone her old doctor. And it's the fact that, of course, no mobile phone. So she's using a phone booth and she's phoned them up. And they're like, oh, we'll call it. She goes, all right, phone me back on this number. And then she has to wait in the phone box. And she just feels so vulnerable, because I think just the way the camera's framed, so you just see the glass walls, so she feels so exposed to the rest of the world, and you just see people walking towards the phone booth. And there's that thing like, is this someone they got? And then suddenly, there's the sequence where the camera really goes up close on her face, and as it pulls back, you see there's just a man with his back just standing right by the phone booth. And you're like, oh my God, who's that? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he vaguely resembles
the doctor. I thought, is that the doctor? Oh my God, he's heard everything. Yeah, it's just weirdly creepy. And essentially a phone call from a phone booth. Yet there is such tension in the entire sequence. I thought it was just great. And the other bit was when she's escaped back into, she's sort of evaded them as they're trying to take her back to the flat, and she locked them out of her apartment, and she doesn't realise there's a secret entrance into her apartment, and she's sort of trying to phone a friend, and then just as she's on the phone again, her on the phone, behind her you just see them walk by, like sort of by, and you're
that's
like,
it. You're like, oh my God, they're in here.
It's such a weird violation. That's what it felt like. It's like they'd violated her, like violated her space. I don't know why, but it's just that, and they're almost grinning as they do it as well. They kind of, it's like they're playing with her. It's horrible.
It is horrible. Like it's almost unbearable tension towards the end of the film where you just want her to escape, you want her to flee. You know, it's like, and like I was saying earlier, a different actress in the role, I don't think I would have felt so strongly about it. Mia Farrow is that perfect. She plays that perfect kind of line between naivety and kind of like strength.
Yeah, and she does. She actively tries to escape her situation. She doesn't. Yeah, you know, she ends up becoming. She almost finds an inner strength. The harder, the worse it gets. And I don't know about you, like there's a sequence where she sort of sits down, like she's like absolutely horrified by everything she's just seen, that the baby has his father's eyes.
Great line, by the way.
And she's
got his father's eyes.
And she sort of sits down, like shocked and horrified, and her husband sort of comes over and tries to explain it, like, oh yeah, they said that you've not really been hurt, it's okay. And there's just that she just spits in his face, and it's such a like moment of like, yeah. Fuck you! Yeah, like it's such a yeah, like,
exactly. He's worse than all the bloody witches
exactly.
put together.
He is the worst out of all of them. He's absolutely portrayed her in the most fundamental way, and she just totally dismisses him. And but then there's a moment where she just sits there and she's sort of looking around. You can see she's sizing everything up. She's pondering her next move. And I don't know about you, but I actually thought she was going to grab the baby and like jump out the window, because there is an earlier in the film when you're introduced to the two main villains, they're looking after a girl, and obviously they were trying, you know, it's a bit, you're a bit unclear as to what they were trying to do to her, but she kills herself, and I thought that was how the film was going to end. It was she was just going to jump out the window with the baby, killing it, her and the baby.
But then it's she much doesn't. More subtle than that.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And did you read, because I've not read the book, but did you actually read what the ending of the book is?
No,
what she decides to do in the book. Well, it's interesting because the film doesn't contradict this. So, and certainly it's slightly ambiguous as to her feelings towards it. But in the book, she decides that she's going to bring him up, but she's going to try and bring him up to be good. She's almost like, well, he's half devil, but he's half me. So, and then she also slightly, I was like, maybe this comes across better in the book, but the notes I was reading, it's like she also decides to make contact with the church and inform the Pope and you know, keep them informed about what's happening. I was like, that just sounds like a really weird, like, I'm going to get the Pope on the line.
Pope, something's going down.
Yeah, that's, just reminded me of that Monty Python sketch, the Bishop. But I thought that was. But the film doesn't contradict that, because you do. You're not, it is very ambiguous as to what she's decided to do.
I mean, I think, you know, of high praise for Mia Farrow's performance, because so many emotions cross her face when she's walking over to that crib. Like, you can see that kind of steely determination return, you know, after being kind of ghosting away from her face, and then as she approaches the crib, it kind of like. You could see a plan start to formulate in her mind.
Yeah, she sort of half smiles. So, you know, you're not sure whether she's just decided, it's my baby, so I'm just going to bring him up anyway. Or, yeah, as the book suggests, that she has a sort of, she's going to fight them anyway and try and bring up the baby to be good.
But then I think it's that awful, that thing as well. Like, you know, the mothering instinct is still there. You know, you found out your child's the devil, and yet you've still got that mothering instinct. You know, that's, it's my child.
And that's perhaps the element we haven't really discussed, which we probably don't really appreciate as men. But there is also the horror of pregnancy. A lot of women find it, you know, like, in popular culture, it's always, it's beautiful. Being pregnant is beautiful. But a lot of women really struggle with being pregnant and find it quite a horrifying experience. Their bodies totally change, and there is something growing inside them, taking their nutrients. They feel nauseous.
Yeah.
They can feel really, really unwell, having to go be hospitalised by what's happening to them.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of pregnancy is quite weird when you actually break it down. It's like you're growing another organism inside you that's not you. You know,
definitely.
It's a foreign being.
Yeah, totally. I remember during the pregnancy, just, you know, occasionally the baby would move around. You'd actually see it moving around. And again, you know, other people go, oh, it's a wonderful, beautiful. Both, you know, me and my wife were like, ugh. It's just weird. It's just like moving around in there. It's an odd, bizarre concept. But
I think, you know, in that kind of sense, it's a body horror, you know, and you could probably put it in the line of David Cronenberg's film for that.
Well,
films for that kind of reason,
especially at the beginning. Well, for the first, like the middle third of the film, she gets really ill. Like, the pregnancy is like horrible. She's in constant pain and she's losing weight, and she looks really drawn out. And yeah, it's a It's this invading thing that is seems to be almost killing her.
Also, she ate raw liver. She actually ate raw liver.
Yes, that's true.
Considering she's a vegetarian, that was impressive bit of acting there. It's such a good film. I mean, do we recommend the film?
Yes, definitely, yeah.
I think we have to recommend this film. It's just brilliant. It's not kind of a horror film.
No, like not at all.
But it's got a creeping sense of dread.
Yes.
Which gets more and more intense as it goes along, and it's just brilliant.
And of course, it's yeah, one thing we didn't mention is produced by William Castle, who was famous for his he directed A House on the Haunted Hill. He was famous for doing things like, you know, Smell-O-Vision and having a skeleton come out of the screen on a bit of wire and in the screen. Yeah. So he was known as a sort of showman, gimmicky director, and he wanted to do this, and he wasn't allowed to direct it because of that reputation, but he really wanted a really serious sort of totally played straight horror film, which this is. And as you say, it's not like, I don't know, like people exploding, you know, or heads exploding or people being stabbed. It is just a sense of creeping dread and like, oh, and also like weirdly how old people just are horrible in this. Like all old people come across as sort of alien and disgusting in some way.
That's
like
it.
And yeah, like they're old, but they're people who are really heavily made up as well. Though, like people, like they're really trying to look young. And there's just, I don't know. It's something, trying to be something they're not, I guess, is the sort of feeling.
You know, normally you think of old people as kindly old people, and then they're just the complete opposite. They're just
from Mulholland Drive, where the you see that kind of old couple, and you see when they get in the car or the limo, and you see them sort of laughing, and then suddenly just look horrific.
Yeah,
that is that it has that sense of just that kind of almost weird sense of disgust and fear of old people. But,
I think that probably ties in really well with the idea that, you know, when this film was made, 1968 was the midst of the kind of auto revolution in American cinema. You know, Bonnie and Clyde had just popped up, and this new generation of young filmmakers was coming through. So no doubt there probably was a bit of feeling that now is the time of the young. You know.
Yeah.
And so there's probably there's something in that, definitely.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Okay, well, happy Halloween to all our listeners at home.
Happy Halloween!
And hopefully we will join you again before Christmas. Well, we can't make any guarantees, but if nothing else, we will do at least a Christmas special again.
We'll clear the decks at least once a month, maybe.
Yes, we'll do our best.
So if you've got any films for us to watch, we will eventually get around to them, even if it does take us 3 years. You can write to us at oneundrawnfilmsyoushouldhaveseen@gmail.com.
You can follow us on Twitter, One Hour Films, and like us on Facebook, One Hour Films. And that goes out to all my old flames as well, just in case they want to recommend some new films, as apparently we're going through them.
And check out our blog at oneundrawnfilmsyoushouldhaveseen.com.
Good stuff. Okay. So, hail Satan to you, Lewis.
And hail Satan to you.
And hail Satan to all our listeners at home.
Bye!
Mia Farrow playing, what's her name? Rosemary. And she has a, what's it called? We've still got it here at One Hour Films.
Boom!
Lightning shot.